and at the same time he knew his brother wouldn't permit him to. Once he said openly, "Let's sleep on that other thing." "Sure, if you want to," said Charles. Gradually they ran out of escape talk. Every acquaintance was covered, and every local event. The talk lagged, and the time went on. "Feel like turning in?" Adam asked. "In a little while." They were silent, and the night moved restlessly about the house, nudging them and urging them. "I sure would have liked to have seen that funeral," said Charles. "Must have been pretty fancy. Would you care to see the clippings from the paper? I've got them all in my room." "No, not tonight." Charles squared his chair around and put his elbows on the table. "We'll have to figure it out," he said nervously. "We can put it off all we want, but we goddamn well got to figure what we're going to do." "I know that," said Adam. "I guess I just wanted some time to think about it." "Would that do any good? I've had time, lots of time, and I just went in circles. I tried not to think about it, and I still went in circles. You think time is going to help?" "I guess not. I guess not. What do you want to talk about first?" "I guess we might as well get into it. We're not thinking about anything else." "There's the money," said Charles. "Over $100,000. A fortune." "What about the money?" "Well, where did it come from?" "How do I know? I told you, you might have speculated. Somebody might have put him onto a good thing there in Washington." "Do you believe that?" "I don't believe anything," Adam said. "I don't know, so what can I believe?" "It's a lot of money," said Charles. "It's a fortune left to us. We can live the rest of our lives on it. Or we can buy a hell of a lot of land and make it pay. Maybe you didn't think about it, but we're rich. We're richer than anybody hereabouts." Adam laughed. "You say it like it was a jail sentence." "Where did it come from?" "What do you care?" Adam asked. "Maybe we should just settle back and enjoy it." "He wasn't at Gettysburg. He wasn't at any goddamn battle in the whole war. He was hitting a skirmish. Everything he told was lies." "What are you getting at?" said Adam. "I think he stole the money," Charles said miserably. "You ask me, and that's what I think."
"Do you know where he stole it?"
"No."
"Then why do you think he stole it?"
"He told lies about the war."
"What?
I mean, if he lied about the war, why, he could steal."
"How?"
"He held jobs in the GAR, big jobs. He maybe could have got into the Treasury, rigged the books."
Adam sighed.
"Well, if that's what you think, why don't you write to them and tell them? Have them go over the books. If it's true, we could give back the money."
Charles's face was twisted, and the scar on his forehead showed dark.
"The vice president came to his funeral. The president sent a wreath. There was a line of carriages half a mile long and hundreds of people on foot. And do you know who the pallbearers were?"
"What are you digging at?"
"Suppose we found out he's a thief. Then it would come out how he was never at Gettysburg or any place else. Then everybody would know he was a liar, too, and his whole life was a goddamn lie. Then even if sometimes he did tell the truth, nobody would believe it was the truth."
Adam sat very still. His eyes were untroubled, but he was watchful.
"I thought you loved him," he said calmly. He felt released and free. "I did. I do. And that's why I hate this. His whole life gone, all gone. And his grave, they might even dig him up and throw him out."
His words were ragged with emotion.
"Didn't you love him at all?" he cried.
"I wasn't sure until now," said Adam. "I was all mixed up with how I was supposed to feel. No, I did not love him."
"Then you don't care if his life is spoiled and his poor body rooted up and
Oh, my God almighty.
Adam's brain raced, trying to find words for his feeling. I don't have to care.
No, you don't, Charles said bitterly. Not if you didn't love him, you don't. You can help kick him in the face.
Adam knew that his brother was no longer dangerous. There was no jealousy to drive him. The whole weight of his father was on him, but it was his father, and no one could take his father away from him.
How will you feel walking in town after everyone knows? Charles demanded. How will you face anybody?
I told you, I don't care. I don't have to care because I don't believe it.
You don't believe what?
I don't believe he stole any money. I believe in the war he did just what he said he did and was just where he said he was.
But the proof? How about the discharge?
You haven't any proof that he stole. You just made that up because you don't know where the money came from.
His army papers. They could be wrong, Adam said. I believe they are wrong. I believe in my father. I don't see how you can.
Adam said, let me tell you, the proofs that God doesn't exist are very strong. But in lots of people, they are not as strong as the feeling that he does.
But you said you didn't love our father. How can you have faith in him if you didn't love him?
Maybe that's the reason, Adam said slowly, feeling his way. Maybe if I had loved him, I would have been jealous of him.
You were.
Maybe love makes you suspicious and doubting.
Is it true that when you love a woman, you're never sure of her because you aren't sure of yourself?
I can see it pretty clearly. I can see how you loved him and what it did to you.
I didn't love him. Maybe he loved me. He tested me and hurt me and punished me. And finally he sent me out like a sacrifice. Maybe to make up for something.
But he didn't love you. And so he had faith in you.
Maybe it's a kind of reverse.
Charles stared at him.
I don't understand, he said. I'm trying to, said Adam. It's a new thought to me. I feel good. I feel better, maybe, than I have ever felt in my whole life. I've got rid of something. Maybe sometime I'll get what you have, but I haven't got it now.
I don't understand, Charles said again. Can you see that I don't think our father was a thief? I don't believe he was a liar.
But the papers.
I won't look at the papers. Papers are no match at all for my faith in my father.
Charles was breathing heavily. Then you would take the money?
Of course.
Even if he stole it?
He didn't steal it. He couldn't have stolen it.
I don't understand, said Charles.
You don't? Well, it does seem that maybe this might be the secret of the whole thing. Look, I've never mentioned this. Do you remember when you beat me up just before I went away?
Yes. Do you remember later you came back with a hatchet to kill me?
I don't remember very well. I must have been crazy. I didn't know then, but I know now. You were fighting for your love.
Love?
Yes, said Adam. We'll use the money well. Maybe we'll stay here. Maybe we'll go away. Maybe to California. We'll have to see what we'll do. And of course, we must set up a monument to our father. A big one.
I couldn't ever go away from here, said Charles.
Well, let's see how it goes. There's no hurry. We'll feel it out.
Chapter 8. I believe there are monsters born in the world to human parents. Some you can see, misshapen and horrible, with huge heads or tiny bodies. Some are born with no arms, no legs. Some with three arms. Some with tails or mouths in odd places. They are accidents and no one's fault, as used to be thought. Once they were considered the visible punishments for concealed sins. And just as there are physical monsters, can there not be mental or psychic monsters born? The face and body may be perfect, but if a twisted gene or a malformed egg can produce physical monsters, may not the same process produce a malformed soul? Monsters are variations from the accepted normal to a greater or less degree. As a child may be born without an arm, so one may be born without kindness or the potential of conscience. A man who loses his arm in an accident has a great struggle to adjust himself to the lack, but one born without arms suffers only from people who find him strange. Having never had arms, he cannot miss them. Sometimes when we are little, we imagine how it would be to have wings, but there is no reason to suppose it is the same feeling birds have. No, to a monster, the norm must seem monstrous, since everyone is normal to himself. To the inner monster, it must be even more obscure, since he has no visible thing to compare with others. To a man born without conscience, a soul-stricken man must seem ridiculous. To a criminal, honesty is foolish. You mustn't forget that a monster is only a variation, and that to a monster, the norm is monstrous. It is my belief that Kathy Ames was born with the tendencies, or lack of them, which drove and forced her all of her life. Some balance wheel was misweighted, some gear out of ratio. She wasn't like other people, never was from birth. And just as a cripple may learn to utilize his lack so that he becomes more effective in a limited field than the uncrippled, so did Kathy, using her difference, make a painful and bewildering stir in her world. There was a time when a girl like Kathy would have been called possessed by the devil. She would have been exorcised to cast out the evil spirit, and if, after many trials, that didn't work, she would have been burned as a witch for the good of the community. The one thing that may not be forgiven a witch is her ability to distress people, to make them restless and uneasy and even envious. As though nature concealed a trap, Kathy had from the first a face of innocence. Her hair was gold and lovely. Wide-set hazel eyes with upper lids that drooped made her look mysteriously sleepy. Her nose was delicate and thin, and her cheekbones high and wide, sweeping down to a small chin so that her face was heart-shaped. Her mouth was well-shaped and well-lipped, but abnormally small, what used to be called a rosebud. Her ears were very little, without lobes, and they pressed so close to her head that even with her hair combed up, they made no silhouette. They were thin flaps sealed against her head. Kathy always had a child's figure, even after she was grown. Slender, delicate arms and hands, tiny hands. Her breasts never developed very much. Before her puberty, the nipples turned inward. Her mother had to manipulate them out when they became painful in Kathy's 10th year. Her body was a boy's body, narrow-hipped, straight-legged, but her ankles were thin and straight without being slender. Her feet were small and round and stubby, with fat insteps, almost like little hoofs. She was a pretty child, and she became a pretty woman. Her voice was huskily soft, and it could be so sweet as to be irresistible. But there must have been some steel cord in her throat, for Kathy's voice could cut like a file when she wished. Even as a child, she had some quality that made people look at her, then look away, then look back at her, troubled at something foreign. Something looked out of her eyes and was never there when one looked again. She moved quietly and talked little, but she could enter no room without causing everyone to turn toward her. She made people uneasy, but not so that they wanted to go away from her. Men and women wanted to inspect her, to be close to her, to try to find what caused the disturbance she distributed so subtly. And since this had always been so, Kathy didn't find it strange. Kathy was different from other children in many ways, but one thing in particular set her apart. Most children abhor difference. They want to look, talk, dress, and act exactly like all the others. If the style of dress is an absurdity, it is pain and sorrow to a child not to wear that absurdity. If necklaces of pork chops were accepted, it would be a sad child who could not wear pork chops. And this slavishness to the group normally extends to every game, every practice, social or otherwise. It is a protective coloration children utilize for their safety. Kathy had none of this. She never conformed in dress or conduct. She wore whatever she wanted to. The result was that quite often other children imitated her. As she grew older, the group, the herd, which is any collection of children, began to sense what adults felt, that there was something foreign about Kathy. After a while, only one person at a time associated with her. Groups of boys and girls avoided her as though she carried a nameless danger. Kathy was a liar, but she didn't lie the way most children do. Hers was no daydream lying. When the thing imagined is told, and, to make it seem more real, told as real. That is just ordinary deviation from external reality. I think the difference between a lie and a story is that a story utilizes the trappings and appearance of truth for the interest of the listener as well as of the teller. A story has in it neither gain nor loss, but a lie is a device for profit or escape. I suppose if that definition is strictly held to, then a writer of stories is a liar, if he is financially fortunate. Kathy's lies were never innocent. Their purpose was to escape punishment, or work, or responsibility, and they were used for profit. Most liars are tripped up either because they forget what they have told, or because the lie is suddenly faced with an incontrovertible truth. But Kathy didn't forget her lies. And she developed the most effective method of lying. She stayed close enough to the truth so that one could never be sure. She knew two other methods also, either to interlard her lies with truth or to tell a truth as though it were a lie. If one is accused of a lie and it turns out to be the truth, there is a backlog that will last a long time and protect a number of untruths. Since Kathy was an only child, her mother had no close contrast in the family. She thought all children were like her own. And since all parents are worriers, she was convinced that all her friends had the same problems. Kathy's father wasn't so sure. He operated a small tannery in a town in Massachusetts, which made a comfortable, careful living if he worked very hard. Mr. Ames came in contact with other children away from his home, and he felt that Kathy was not like other children. It was a matter more felt than known. He was uneasy about his daughter, but he couldn't have said why. Nearly everyone in the world has appetites and impulses, trigger emotions, islands of selfishness, lusts, just beneath the surface. And most people either hold such things in check or indulge them secretly. Kathy knew not only these impulses in others, but how to use them for her own gain. It is quite possible that she didn't believe in any other tendencies in humans, for while she was preternaturally alert in some directions, she was completely blind in others. Kathy learned when she was very young that sexuality, with all its attendant yearnings and pains, jealousies and taboos, is the most disturbing impulse humans have. And in that day, it was even more disturbing than it is now, because the subject was unmentionable and unmentioned. Everyone concealed that little hell in himself, while publicly pretending it didn't exist. And when he was caught up in it, he was completely helpless. Kathy learned that by the manipulation and use of this one part of people, she could gain and keep power over nearly anyone. It was at once a weapon and a threat. It was irresistible. And since the blind helplessness seems never to have fallen on Kathy, it is probable that she had very little of the impulse herself, and indeed felt a contempt for those who did. And when you think of it in one way, she was right. What freedom men and women could have, were they not constantly tricked and trapped and enslaved and tortured by their sexuality. The only drawback in that freedom is that without it, one wouldn't be human. One would be a monster. At 10, Kathy knew something of the power of the sex impulse and began coldly to experiment with it. She planned everything coldly, foreseeing difficulties and preparing for them. The sex play of children has always gone on. Everyone, I guess, who is not abnormal, has foregathered with little girls in some dim, leafy place, in the bottom of a manger, under a willow, in a culvert under the road, or at least has dreamed of doing so. Nearly all parents are faced with the problem sooner or later, and then the child is lucky if the parent remembers his own childhood. In the time of Kathy's childhood, however, it was harder. The parents, denying it in themselves, were horrified to find it in their children. On a spring morning, when with late surviving dew the young grass bristled under the sun, when the warmth crept into the ground and pushed the yellow dandelions up, Kathy's mother finished hanging the washed clothes on the line. The Ameses lived on the edge of town, and behind their house were barn and carriage house, vegetable garden, and fenced paddock for two horses. Mrs. Ames remembered having seen Kathy stroll away toward the barn. She called for her, and when there was no answer, she thought she might have been mistaken. She was about to go into the house when she heard a giggle from the carriage house. "Kathy?" she called. There was no answer. An uneasiness came over her. She reached back in her mind for the sound of the giggle. It had not been Kathy's voice. Kathy was not a giggler. There is no knowing how or why dread comes on a parent. Of course, many times apprehension arises when there is no reason for it at all. And it comes most often to the parents of only children, parents who have indulged in black dreams of loss. Mrs. Ames stood still, listening. She heard soft, secret voices and moved quietly toward the carriage house. The double doors were closed. The murmur of voices came from inside, but she couldn't make out Kathy's voice. She made a quick stride and pulled the doors open, and the bright sun crashed inside. She froze, mouth open at what she saw. Kathy lay on the floor, her skirts pulled up. She was naked to the waist, and beside her, two boys, about 14, were kneeling. The shock of the sudden light froze them, too. Kathy's eyes were blank with terror. Mrs. Ames knew the boys, knew their parents. Suddenly, one of the boys leaped up, darted past Mrs. Ames, and ran around the corner of the house. The other boy helplessly edged away from the woman, and with a cry, rushed through the doorway. Mrs. Ames clutched at him, but her fingers slipped from his jacket, and he was gone. She could hear his running footsteps outside. Mrs. Ames tried to speak, and her voice was a croaking whisper. "Get up!" Kathy stared blankly up at her and made no move. Mrs. Ames saw that Kathy's wrists were tied with a heavy rope. She screamed and flung herself down and fumbled at the knots. She carried Kathy into the house and put her to bed. The family doctor, after he had examined Kathy, could find no evidence that she had been mistreated. "You can just thank God you got there in time," he said over and over to Mrs. Ames. Kathy didn't speak for a long time. Shock, the doctor called it. And when she did come out of the shock, Kathy refused to talk. When she was questioned, her eyes widened until the whites showed all around the pupils, and her breathing stopped, and her body grew rigid, and her cheeks reddened from holding her breath. The conference with the parents of the boys was attended by Dr. Williams. Mr. Ames was silent most of the time. He carried the rope which had been around Kathy's wrists. His eyes were puzzled. There were things he didn't understand, but he didn't bring them up. Mrs. Ames settled down to a steady hysteria. She had been there. She had seen. She was the final authority. and out of her hysteria, a sadistic devil peered. She wanted blood. There was a kind of pleasure in her demands for punishment. The town, the country, must be protected. She put it on that basis. She had arrived on time, thank God, but maybe the next time she wouldn't. And how would other mothers feel? And Kathy was only 10 years old. Punishments were more savage then than they are now. A man truly believed that the whip was an instrument of virtue. First singly, and then together, the boys were whipped. Whipped to raw cuts. Their crime was bad enough, but the lies proved an evil that not even the whip could remove. And their defense was, from the beginning, ridiculous. Kathy, they said, had started the whole thing, and they had each given her 5 cents. They had not tied her hands. They said they remembered that she was playing with a rope. Mrs. Ames said it first, and the whole town echoed it. Do they mean to say she tied her own hands? A 10-year-old child? If the boys had owned up to the crime, they might have escaped some of the punishment. Their refusal brought a torturing rage, not only to their fathers who did the whipping, but to the whole community. Both boys were sent to a house of correction, with the approval of their parents. She's haunted by it, Mrs. Ames told the neighbors. If she could only talk about it, maybe she would get better. But when I ask her about it, it's like it came right back to her, and she goes into shock again. The Ameses never spoke of it to her again. The subject was closed. Mr. Ames very soon forgot his haunting reservations. He would have felt bad if two boys were in the House of Correction for something they did not do. After Kathy had fully recovered from her shock, boys and girls watched her from a distance and then moved closer, fascinated by her. She had no girl crushes, as is usual at 12 and 13. Boys didn't want to take the chance of being ragged by their friends for walking home from school with her. But she exercised a powerful effect on boys and girls. And if any boy could come on her alone, he found himself drawn to her by a force he could neither understand nor overcome. She was dainty and very sweet, and her voice was low. She went for long walks by herself, and it was a rare walk when some boy didn't blunder out of a woodlot and come on her by accident. And while whispers went scurrying about, there was no knowing what Kathy did. If anything happened, only vague whispers followed. And this in itself was unusual at an age when there are many secrets, and none of them kept long enough to raise a cream. Kathy developed a little smile, just a hint of a smile. She had a way of looking sideways and down that hinted to a lone boy of secrets he could share. In her father's mind, another question stirred, and he shoved it deep down and felt dishonest for thinking about it at all. Kathy had remarkable luck in finding things. A gold charm, money, a little silken purse, a silver cross with red stones, said to be rubies. She found many things, and when her father advertised in the Weekly Courier about the cross, no one ever claimed it. Mr. William Ames, Kathy's father, was a covered man. He rarely told the thoughts in his mind. He wouldn't have dared so far to expose himself to the gaze of his neighbors. He kept the little flame of suspicion to himself. It was better if he didn't know anything, safer, wiser, and much more comfortable. As for Kathy's mother, she was so bound and twisted in a cocoon of gauzy half-lies, warped truth, suggestions, all planted by Kathy, that she would not have known a true thing if it had come to her. Kathy grew more lovely all the time. The delicate, blooming skin, the golden hair, the wide-set, modest, and yet promising eyes, the little mouth full of sweetness, caught attention and held it. She finished the 8 grades of grammar school with such a good record that her parents entered her in the small high school, although in that time it was not usual for a girl to go on with her studies. But Kathy said she wanted to be a teacher, which delighted her mother and father, for this was the one profession of dignity open to a girl of a good but not well-to-do family. Parents took honor from a daughter who was a teacher. Kathy was 14 when she entered high school. She had always been precious to her parents, but with her entrance into the rarities of algebra and Latin, she climbed into clouds where her parents couldn't follow. They had lost her. They felt that she was translated to a higher order. The teacher of Latin was a pale, intense young man who had failed in divinity school and yet had enough education to teach the inevitable grammar, Caesar, Cicero. He was a quiet young man who warmed his sense of failure to his bosom. Deep in himself, he felt that he had been rejected by God and for cause. For a time, it was noticed that a flame leaped in James Grew and some force glowed in his eyes. He was never seen with Kathy, and no relationship was even suspected. James Grew became a man. He walked on his toes and sang to himself. He wrote letters so persuasive that the directors of his divinity school looked favorably on readmitting him. And then the flame went out. His shoulders held so high and square, folded dejectedly. His eyes grew feverish and his hands twitched. He was seen in church at night, on his knees, moving his lips over prayers. He missed school and sent word that he was ill when it was known that he was walking all alone in the hills beyond the town. One night, late, he tapped on the door of the Ames house. Mr. Ames complained his way out of bed, lighted a candle, flung an overcoat over his nightgown, and went to the door. It was a wild and crazy-looking James Grew who stood before him, his eyes shining and his body one big shudder.
"I've got to see you," he said hoarsely to Mr. Ames.
"It's after midnight," Mr. Ames said sternly.
"I've got to see you alone. Put on some clothes and come outside. I've got to talk to you."
"Young man, I think you're drunk or sick. Go home and get some sleep. It's after midnight."
"I can't wait. I've got to talk to you."
"Come down to the tannery in the morning," Mr. Ames said, and he closed the door firmly on the reeling caller and stood inside, listening. He heard the wailing voice.
"I can't wait! I can't wait!"
And then the feet dragged slowly down the steps. Mr. Ames shielded the candlelight away from his eyes with his cupped hand and went back to bed. He thought he saw Kathy's door close very silently. But perhaps the leaping candlelight had fooled his eyes, for a portiere seemed to move, too.
"What in the world?"
his wife demanded when he came back to the bedside. Mr. Ames didn't know why he answered as he did, perhaps to save discussion.
"A drunken man," he said, "got the wrong house." "I don't know what the world is coming to," said Mrs. Ames.
As he lay in the darkness after the light was out, he saw the green circle left in his eyes by the candle flame, and in its whirling, pulsing frame, he saw the frantic, beseeching eyes of James Grew. He didn't go back to sleep for a long time. In the morning, a rumor ran through the town, distorted here and there, added to, but by afternoon, the story clarified. The sexton had found James Grew stretched on the floor in front of the altar. The whole top of his head was blown off. Beside him lay a shotgun, and beside it, the piece of stick with which he had pushed the trigger. Near him on the floor was a candlestick from the altar. One of the three candles was still burning. The other two had not been lighted. And on the floor were two books, the hymnal and the Book of Common Prayer, one on top of the other. The way the sexton figured it, James Grew had propped the gun barrel on the books to bring it in line with his temple. The recoil of the discharge had thrown the shotgun off the books. A number of people remembered having heard an explosion early in the morning, before daylight. James Grew left no letter. No one could figure out why he had done it. Mr. Ames' first impulse was to go to the coroner with his story of the midnight call. Then he thought, what good would it do? If I knew anything, it would be different, but I don't know a single thing. He had a sick feeling in his stomach. He told himself over and over that it was not his fault. How could he have helped it? I don't even know what he wanted. He felt guilty and miserable. At dinner, his wife talked about the suicide, and he couldn't eat. Kathy sat silent, but no more silent than usual. She ate with little dainty nips and wiped her mouth often on her napkin. Mrs. Ames went over the matter of the body and the gun in detail. "There's one thing I want to speak of," she said. "That drunken man who came to the door last night, could that have been young Grew?" "No," he said quickly.
"Are you sure? Could you see him in the dark?"
"I had a candle," he said sharply. "Didn't look anything like, had a big beard."
"No need to snap at me," she said. "I just wondered."
Kathy wiped her mouth, and when she laid the napkin on her lap, she was smiling. Mrs. Ames turned to her daughter.
"You saw him every day at school, Kathy. Has he seemed sad lately? Did you notice anything that might mean..."
Kathy looked down at her plate and then up.
"I thought he was sick," she said. "Yes, he has looked bad. Everybody was talking in school today, and somebody, I don't remember who, said that Mr. Grew was in some kind of trouble in Boston. I didn't hear what kind of trouble. We all liked Mr. Grew."
She wiped her lips delicately. That was Kathy's method. Before the next day was out, everybody in town knew that James Grew had been in trouble in Boston. And no one could possibly imagine that Kathy had planted the story. Even Mrs. Ames had forgotten where she heard it.
This ends Disc 3. East of Eden, Disc 4.
Soon after her 16th birthday, a change came over Kathy. One morning, she didn't get up for school. Her mother went into her room and found her in bed, staring at the ceiling.
"Hurry, you'll be late. It's nearly 9.
"I'm not going."
There was no emphasis in her voice.
"Are you sick?"
"No."
"Then hurry, get up."
"I'm not going."
"You must be sick. You've never missed a day."
"I'm not going to school," Kathy said calmly. "I'm never going to school again."
Her mother's mouth fell open.
"What do you mean?"
"Not ever," said Kathy, and continued to stare at the ceiling.
"Well, we'll just see what your father has to say about that. With all our work and expense, and 2 years before you get your certificate?"
Then she came close and said softly,
"You aren't thinking of getting married."
"No."
"What's that book you're hiding?"
"Here, I'm not hiding it."
"Oh, Alice in Wonderland. You're too big for that."
Kathy said, "I can get to be so little, you can't even see me."
"What in the world are you talking about?"
"Nobody can find me."
Her mother said angrily, "Stop making jokes. I don't know what you're thinking of. What does Miss Fancy think she's going to do?"
"I don't know yet," said Kathy. "I think I'll go away."
"Well, you just lie there, Miss Fancy, and when your father comes home, he'll have a thing or two to say to you."
Kathy turned her head very slowly and looked at her mother. Her eyes were expressionless and cold. And suddenly Mrs. Ames was afraid of her daughter. She went out quietly and closed the door. In her kitchen, she sat down and cupped her hands in her lap and stared out the window at the weathering carriage house. Her daughter had become a stranger to her. She felt, as most parents do at one time or another, that she was losing control, that the bridle put in her hands for the governing of Kathy was slipping through her fingers. She did not know that she had never had any power over Kathy. She had been used for Kathy's purposes always. And after a while, Mrs. Ames put on a bonnet and went to the tannery. She wanted to talk to her husband away from the house.
In the afternoon, Kathy rose listlessly from her bed and spent a long time in front of the mirror. That evening, Mr. Ames, hating what he had to do, delivered a lecture to his daughter. He spoke of her duty, her obligation, her natural love for her parents. Toward the end of his speech, he was aware that she wasn't listening to him. This made him angry, and he fell into threats. He spoke of the authority God had given him over his child, and of how this natural authority had been armed by the state. He had her attention now. She looked him right in the eye. Her mouth smiled a little, and her eyes didn't seem to blink. Finally, he had to look away, and this enraged him further. He ordered her to stop her nonsense. Vaguely, he threatened her with whipping if she didn't obey him. He ended on a note of weakness. "I want you to promise me that you will go to school in the morning and stop your foolishness." Her face was expressionless. The little mouth was straight. "All right," she said. Later that night, Mr. Ames said to his wife with an assurance he did not feel, "You see, it just needs a little authority. Maybe we've been too lax. But she has been a good child. I guess she just forgot who's boss. A little sternness never hurt anybody." He wished he were as confident as his words. In the morning, she was gone. Her straw traveling basket was gone and the best of her clothing. Her bed was neatly made. The room was impersonal, nothing to indicate that a girl had grown up in it. There were no pictures, no mementos, none of the normal clutter of growing. Kathy had never played with dolls. The room had no Kathy imprint. In his way, Mr. Ames was an intelligent man. He clapped on his derby hat and walked quickly to the railroad station. The station agent was certain. Kathy had taken the early morning train. She had bought a ticket for Boston. He helped Mr. Ames write a telegram to the Boston police. Mr. Ames bought a round-trip ticket and caught the 9:50 train to Boston. He was a very good man in a crisis. That night, Mrs. Ames sat in the kitchen with the door closed. She was white, and she gripped the table with her hands to control her shaking. The sound, first of the blows and then of the screaming, came clearly to her through the closed doors. Mr. Ames was not good at whipping, because he had never done it. He lashed at Kathy's legs with a buggy whip, and when she stood quietly staring at him with calm, cold eyes, he lost his temper. The first blows were tentative and timid, but when she didn't cry, he slashed at her sides and shoulders. The whip licked and cut. In his rage, he missed her several times or got too close so that the whip wrapped around her body. Kathy learned quickly. She found him out and knew him. And once she had learned, she screamed, she writhed, she cried, she begged. And she had the satisfaction of feeling the blows instantly become lighter. Mr. Ames was frightened at the noise and hurt he was creating. He stopped. Kathy dropped back on the bed, sobbing. And if he had looked, her father would have seen that there were no tears in her eyes, but rather the muscles of her neck were tight and there were lumps just under her temples where the jaw muscle knotted. He said, "No, will you ever do that again?"
"No, oh no, forgive me," Kathy said.
She turned over on the bed so that her father couldn't see the coldness in her face.
"See, you remember who you are, and don't forget what I am."
Kathy's voice caught. She produced a dry sob.
"I won't forget," she said.
In the kitchen, Mrs. Ames wrestled her hands. Her husband put his fingers on her shoulder.
"I hated to do it," he said. "I had to. And I think it did her good. She seems like a changed girl to me. Maybe we haven't bent the twig enough. We've spared the rod. Maybe we were wrong."
And he knew that although his wife had insisted on the whipping, although she had forced him to whip Kathy, she hated him for doing it. Despair settled over him. There seemed no doubt that it was what Kathy needed.
As Mr. Ames said, it kind of opened her up. She had always been tractable, but now she became thoughtful, too. In the weeks that followed, she helped her mother in the kitchen and offered to help more than was needed. She started to knit an afghan for her mother, a large project that would take months. Mrs. Ames told the neighbors about it. She has such a fine color sense, rust and yellow. She's finished 3 squares already. For her father, Kathy kept a ready smile. She hung up his hat when he came in and turned his chair properly under the light to make it easy for him to read. Even in school, she was changed. Always she had been a good student, but now she began to make plans for the future. She talked to the principal about examinations for her teaching certificate, perhaps a year early. And the principal looked over her record and thought she might well try it with hope of success. He called on Mr. Ames at the tannery to discuss it. "She didn't tell us any of this," Mr. Ames said proudly. "Well, Mamie, I shouldn't have told you. I hope I haven't ruined a surprise." Mr. and Mrs. Ames felt that they had blundered on some magic which solved all of their problems. They put it down to an unconscious wisdom which comes only to parents. "I never saw such a change in a person in my life," Mr. Ames said. "But she was always a good child," said his wife. "And have you noticed how pretty she's getting? Why, she's almost beautiful. Her cheeks have so much color."
"I don't think she'll be teaching school long with her looks," said Mr. Ames.
It was true that Kathy glowed. The childlike smile was constantly on her lips while she went about her preparations. She had all the time in the world. She cleaned the cellar and stuffed papers all around the edges of the foundation to block the draft. When the kitchen door squeaked, she oiled the hinges and then the lock that turned too hard. And while she had the oil can out, she oiled the front door hinges, too. She made it her duty to keep the lamps filled and their chimneys clean. She invented a way of dipping the chimneys in a big can of kerosene she had in the basement.
"You'd have to see it to believe it," her father said.
And it wasn't only at home, either. She braved the smell of the tannery to visit her father. She was just past 16, and of course he thought of her as a baby. He was amazed at her questions about business.
"She's smarter than some men I could name," he told his foreman. "She might be running the business someday."
She was interested not only in the tanning processes, but in the business end, too. Her father explained the loans, the payments, the billing, and the payroll. He showed her how to open the safe, and was pleased that after the first try, she remembered the combination.
"The way I look at it is this," he told his wife. "We've all of us got a little of the old Nick in us. I wouldn't want a child that didn't have some gumption. The way I see it, that's just a kind of energy. If you can just check it and keep it in control, why, it'll go in the right direction."
Kathy mended all of her clothes and put her things in order. One day in May, she came home from school and went directly to her knitting needles. Her mother was dressed to go out. "I have to go to the Altar Guild," she said. "It's about the cake sale next week. I'm chairman." "Your father wondered if you would go by the bank and pick up the money for the payroll and take it to the tannery. I told him about the cake sale, so I can't do it."
"I'd like to," Kathy said.
"They'll have the money ready for you in a bag," said Mrs. Ames, and she hurried out. Kathy worked quickly, but without hurry. She put on an old apron to cover her clothes. In the basement, she found a jelly jar with a top and carried it out to the carriage house, where the tools were kept. In the chicken yard, she caught a little pullet, took it to the block and chopped its head off, and held the writhing neck over the jelly jar until it was half full of blood. Then she carried the quivering pullet to the manure pile and buried it deep. Back in the kitchen, she took off the apron and put it in the stove and poked the coals until a flame sprang up on the cloth. She washed her hands and inspected her shoes and stockings and wiped a dark spot from the toe of her right shoe. She looked at her face in the mirror. Her cheeks were bright with color,
and her eyes shone, and her mouth turned up in its small, childlike smile. On her way out, she hid the jelly jar under the lowest part of the kitchen steps. Her mother had not been gone even 10 minutes. Kathy walked lightly, almost dancingly, around the house and into the street. The trees were breaking into leaf, and a few early dandelions were in yellow flower on the lawns. Kathy walked gaily toward the center of the town where the bank was. And she was so fresh and pretty that people walking turned and looked after her when she had passed. The fire broke out at about 3 o'clock in the morning. It rose, flared, roared, crashed, and crumbled in on itself almost before anyone noticed it. When the volunteers ran up, pulling their hose cart, there was nothing for them to do but wet down the roofs of the neighboring houses to keep them from catching fire. The Ames house had gone up like a rocket. The volunteers and the ordinary audience fires attract looked around at the lighted faces, trying to see Mr. and Mrs. Ames and their daughter. It came to everyone at once that they weren't there. People gazed at the broad ember bed and saw themselves and their children in there, and hearts rose up and pumped against throats. The volunteers began to dump water on the fire, almost as though they might even so late save some corporeal part of the family. The frightened talk ran through the town that the whole Ames family had burned. By sunrise, everyone in town was tight-packed about the smoking black pile. Those in front had to shield their faces against the heat. The volunteers continued to pump water to cool off the charred mess. By noon, the coroner was able to throw wet planks down and probe with a crowbar among the sodden heaps of charcoal. Enough remained of Mr. and Mrs. Ames to make sure there were two bodies. Near neighbors pointed out the approximate place where Kathy's room had been, but although the coroner and any number of helpers worked over the debris with a garden rake, they could find no tooth or bone. The chief of the volunteers, meanwhile, had found the doorknobs and lock of the kitchen door. He looked at the blackened metal, puzzled, but not quite knowing what puzzled him. He borrowed the coroner's rake and worked furiously. He went to the place where the front door had been and raked until he found that lock, crooked and half-melted. By now he had his own small crowd who demanded, "What are you looking for, George?" and "What did you find, George?" Finally, the coroner came over to him. "What's on your mind, George?" "No keys in the locks," the chief said uneasily. "Maybe they fell out." "How?" "Maybe they melted." "The locks didn't melt." "Maybe Bill Ames took them out." "On the inside?" He held up his trophies. Both bolts stuck out. Since the owner's house was burned, and the owner ostensibly burned with it, the employees of the tannery, out of respect, didn't go to work. They hung around the burned house, offering to help in any way they could, feeling official and generally getting in the way. It wasn't until afternoon that Joel Robinson, the foreman, went down to the tannery. He found the safe open and papers scattered all over the floor. A broken window showed how the thief had entered. Now the whole complexion changed. So it wasn't an accident. Fear took the place of excitement and sorrow, and anger, brother of fear, crept in. The crowd began to spread. They hadn't far to go. In the carriage house there was what is called signs of a struggle. In this case, a broken box, a shattered carriage lamp, scraped marks in the dust, and straw on the floor. The onlookers might not have known these as signs of a struggle had there not been a quantity of blood on the floor. The constable took control. This was his province. He pushed and herded everyone out of the carriage house. "Want to gum up all the clues?" he shouted at them. "Now y'all stay clear outside the door." He searched the room, picked up something, and in a corner found something else.
He came to the door holding his discoveries in his hands, a blood-spattered blue hair ribbon and a cross with red stones.
"Anybody recognize these here?" he demanded.
In a small town where everyone knows everyone, it is almost impossible to believe that one of your acquaintance could murder anyone. For that reason, if the signs are not pretty strong in a particular direction, it must be some dark stranger, some wanderer from the outside world where such things happen. Then the hobo camps are raided, and vagrants brought in, and hotel registers scrutinized. Every man who is not known is automatically suspected. It was May, remember, and the wandering men had only recently taken to the roads, now that the warming months let them spread their blankets by any watercourse. And the gypsies were out, too, a whole caravan less than 5 miles away. And what a turning out those poor gypsies got. The ground for miles around was searched for new-turned earth, and likely pools were dragged for Kathy's body. "She was so pretty," everyone said, and they meant that in themselves they could see a reason for carrying Kathy off. At length, a bumbling, hairy half-wit was brought in for questioning. He was a fine candidate for hanging, because not only did he have no alibis, but he couldn't remember what he had done at any time in his life. His feeble mind sensed that these questioners wanted something of him, and, being a friendly creature, he tried to give it to them. When a baited and set question was offered to him, he walked happily into the trap, and was glad when the constable looked happy. He tried manfully to please these superior beings. There was something very nice about him. The only trouble with his confession was that he confessed too much in too many directions. Also, he had constantly to be reminded of what he was supposed to have done. He was really pleased when he was indicted by a stern and frightened jury. He felt that at last he amounted to something. There were, and are, some men who become judges whose love for the law and for its intention of promoting justice has the quality of love for a woman. Such a man presided at the examination before plea, a man so pure and good that he canceled out a lot of wickedness with his life. Without the prompting the culprit was used to, his confession was nonsense. The judge questioned him and found out that although the suspect was trying to follow instructions, he simply couldn't remember what he did, whom he killed, how or why. The judge sighed wearily and motioned him out of the courtroom and crooked his fingers at the constable. "Now look here, Mike," he said. "You shouldn't do a thing like that. If that poor fellow had been just a little smarter, you might have got him hanged."
"He said he did it."
The constable's feelings were hurt because he was a conscientious man. "He would have admitted climbing the golden stairs and cutting St. Peter's throat with a bowling ball," the judge said. "Be more careful, Mike. The law was designed to save, not to destroy." In all such local tragedies, time works like a damp brush on watercolor. The sharp edges blur. The ache goes out of it. The colors melt together, and from the many separated lines a solid gray emerges. Within a month it was not so necessary to hang someone, and within 2 months nearly everybody discovered that there wasn't any real evidence against anyone. If it hadn't been for Kathy's murder, fire and robbery might have been a coincidence. Then it occurred to people that without Kathy's body you couldn't prove anything, even though you thought she was dead. Kathy left a scent of sweetness behind her. Chapter 9. Mr. Edwards carried on his business of whoremaster in an orderly and unemotional way. He maintained his wife and his 2 well-mannered children in a good house in a good neighborhood in Boston. The children, 2 boys, were entered on the books at Groton when they were infants. Mrs. Edwards kept a dustless house and controlled her servants. There were, of course, many times when Mr. Edwards had to be away from home on business, but he managed to live an amazingly domestic life, and to spend more evenings at home than you could imagine. He ran his business with a public accountant's neatness and accuracy. He was a large and powerful man, running a little to fat in his late 40s, and yet in surprisingly good condition for a time when a man wanted to be fat, if only to prove he was a success. He had invented his business,